So welcome to another episode of the Leadership Enigma, and this episode could go anywhere. Question for today: how can the power of improvisation dial up your leadership to the next level? And I'm going to have Adam Kingle and Neil Malarkey with me as we explore the various answers to that question.
In a constantly changing world, today is as simple as it gets. You're listening to The Leadership Enigma, a podcast to explore, experiment, and power up your leadership to make the difference to your business, your people, and your success. Whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, or corporate executive, each week we dig deep into global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors. Now, here's your host, Adam Pacifico.
You've got to be impressed with that, haven't you, chaps, really?
That's amazing. I'd like to think of myself as an ambitious upstart.
Do you know what? As that was being played, I could see Neil. I could see the look on your face thinking, which one of those shall I be today? But it is brilliant. I've got Adam Kingle and Neil Malarkey with me on this episode, which we are calling Laugh to Lead. And rather than me get it horribly wrong, I'm going to ask each to introduce themselves. And I'm going to go to Adam first, because Adam Kingle very kindly was on my podcast last year as the author of Next Generation Leadership. But Adam, introduce yourself to all three listeners.
Thanks, Adam. I have to, before I introduce myself, I just have to ask Adam, if when we go back to the world of face-to-face, are you going to have a lackey following you about so when you enter rooms, you can say, now Adam Pacifico is...
You can see where this is going. You can see where this is going, can't you? I'll believe my own hype.
The effect in any medium.
Correct.
So my name is Adam Kingle. I'm delighted to be back on your podcast, Adam. So your listeners might remember I'm the author of a wee little book called Next Generation Leadership that came out last year. It was published by HarperCollins, in which I talk about the future of work and the paradigms of some of the youngest generation in the workforce. I'm an adjunct faculty at a number of institutions. I do executive education. I'm an author, educator, consultant. But why am I here? My first career is I was a theater director. And in addition to directing plays, I also both performed and directed in a couple of improv groups, both in the UK and in the US. And my next book is hopefully going to be called A New Renaissance, and will hopefully cover how improv can be helpful in our world of work.
Adam, absolutely brilliant to have you back. And I'm looking forward to that second book as well. Neil Malarkey, welcome to the Leadership Enigma. We have chatted a number of times, but tell the world about you.
Thank you. Well, my name is Neil Malarkey. That's my actual name. Even this weekend on Twitter, somebody said, are you sure? So I come from the world of theatre, and specifically, I'm one of the Comedy Store players, and we do improv and have been doing it since 1985, since before you were born.
Oh, bless.
And for the last 20 years or so, since the turn of the century, I've been teaching improv to business people. So I come from a similar background to Adam, but he's got deeper into adjunct professorship. I'm very envious of the adjunct. I swan about some business schools. I pop into corporate events. I do keynote speeches and teach improv skills. Now, one thing people may not know is, what is improv? Improv for me is a type of theater where the audience gives suggestions to the actors and the actors act it out. And I was taught this by Mike Myers, who is Shrek, Austin Powers, Wayne of Wayne's World.
Wow.
We started the Comedy Store Players, and that's why I'm in a couple of his Austin Powers films, which people smile at when I tell them that.
That is quite amazing. I can't really compete with that. But it's great to have both of you here. And I like these three-way conversations because there can be some mischief and they can end up going anywhere. So here's a question for you. What on earth is improv?
Well, I'll give you the simplest definition that I can think of, and I hope if it isn't elegant in its simplicity, then it will be awkward in its brevity, and that is spontaneous storytelling.
Okay.
You can ask me later about why that might be useful or relevant for business, but that's my working definition.
Spontaneous storytelling. Okay, Neil.
That's pretty good. The form of improv of which I'm part started in the 1920s in Chicago with a social worker and her son, then created Second City Theatre Company. But a lot of people don't know what improv is. They think it's stand-up.
Yeah.
And I often ask people at the beginning of a session I'm doing, and they think it's stand-up, they think it's theatre per se. But the type of improv I'm talking about is a form of theatre where audiences give suggestions to actors and then actors create sketches, scenes, songs and stories from those suggestions.
Right. And when I see that in action, it's quite awe-inspiring. And I know that I've been one of those people sat in the audience of whether it's improvised comedy, improvised theatre, improvised musical theatre. And I know you know some of the people that I'm referring to. I'm kind of there with mouth aghast thinking, how is that even possible? How is it even possible?
Well, I was the same. I didn't believe it. I didn't believe it. I'd never seen an improv show till I was in one. I was in the Cambridge Footlights, which is a Cambridge University sketch group that Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie, Peter Cook, Monty Python, Olivia Colman, Sacha Baron Cohen.
Well, you come from good stock, don't you?
And that's very much scripted comedy. You write it, you test it with a small crowd, and then you road test it. And then by the time it gets to the Edinburgh Festival, it's fully scripted and set in stone. So our tour manager one night came back saying, I've seen this improv thing where they make it up as they go along. No. They always ordered suggestions. No. I said, I can't see how that would work. And then I met Mike Myers, who was selling tickets for a show I was in, a former Cambridge Footlights show. He'd heard of Cambridge Footlights because of Monty Python. I'd heard of Second City because I liked the Blues Brothers and Saturday Night Live. And he said, yes, there is this thing. And there's a whole ethos. Basically, it's all about listening to your fellow player. So that, to me, is where it has huge applications in business.
This is where we start to get into, as you say, its importance and its transferable nature, because of the skills that they're using in order to be so successful at improv, which I know must take years in order to get to that level. But Adam, I think you were going to say something in relation to this aspect of the skills that they use and the applicability beyond improv, beyond theatre and comedy.
Yeah, well, it certainly is a skill, right? I would say, you know, certainly if you imagine people going in to do an improv for the first time, some might be better than others. However, everyone with practice improves. And I guess that's one of the odd things that I often people ask me when I talk about improv, that I've done improv in the past. First question I usually get is, well, why do you guys rehearse? And it's a legitimate question if you don't know the process. Yeah. You know, improv is a technology, right? It's a set of habits and processes and ways of working, much like any organization. Right. When we come together in these social constructs, that in this case, we're talking about business, you have processes and habits and ways of working and paradigms. Yep. And improv just operates along the same way. So why do you rehearse? Not that you're actually going to recreate the scenes in front of a paying audience that you did in rehearsal, but you learn the processes and the habits and the behaviors and the paradigms so that you can then create something spontaneously in front of the paying audience. And I've seen it work incredibly well for A, people who have never done improv before,
right.
B, even people with whom English, for example, is a second or third language. So that hasn't even been an issue. And I guess just to begin with, you know, we can go in so many different directions, but where I've seen it help in the land of business is in confidence, is in improving team dynamics, mm-hmm. is in asking good questions like what the heck is going on here in this relationship, in really understanding and getting quickly to context, to having a shared understanding of your context. But I would say for me, the most important advantage that I've observed of improv in business, just to get right to the meat of the matter,
yep.
if I can just get right to the chunk here, and that is it helps people become curious about fear.
Tell
instead
me,
of avoid it.
Curious about fear. Well, tell me a little bit more about that, because obviously so many organizations we work with right now want to become less risk averse. They're working in highly regulated industries, and I hear the phrase they would really like to be able to take thoughtful risks, but they're frightened.
But they're afraid. Yeah, exactly. And that is the reason, the main reason why I think organizations say they are not as innovative or adaptable or inspirational as any one of the human beings in those organizations.
Right.
And so if we can flip the script, if you will, or indeed get rid of the script and learn some new paradigms and processes and behaviors, then maybe people won't be quite so afraid to adapt, to experiment, to try something new, to ask the curious question. And you're right. And the main barrier is fear. And so what improv just helps them to start to do is to realize they can take some of those risks and that their colleagues don't attack them, knock them down, embarrass them, make them feel small. And then the very next day at work, they have, you know, a newfound ability to try to adapt to play. And that alone, I think, will help business world where we know that change is happening so much faster than it ever has, right? In fact, I would even say constant. The delta of change itself, right, is increasing. So how do we get better at adapting quickly, at making adaptability a reflexive autonomic habit? And improv just is a way in to help you practice the behaviors and therefore grow the confidence to continue to practice those behaviors.
Yeah, it is so relevant, isn't it? And Neil, I want to come back to the experience that you've had. I know you're doing a lot of work now within organizations and have been for some time. But tell me about your experiences, because I love the LinkedIn title you have about co-creating culture, one smile at a time.
Adam Kingle has beautifully told you why improv as an ethos, as a set of practices, works.
Yep.
The other thing to say is I often come out of a day of doing improv or an hour and people say, we had such a laugh. Why can't we do that every day? And I just think, well, if that's all we've achieved, then I've done my job. Of course, we have achieved more. And I would like to think that I've achieved the objective of the workshop, which is all about teamwork. It's all about leadership. It's all about co-creativity. But what's fascinating that I rewrote my LinkedIn thing, you know, co-creating culture one smile at a time. Yeah. I thought that's kind of what I do, is that whatever happens, we have a smile. I'm a performing comedian, so I'm a little bit needy. I need people to be able to laugh with me. But my greatest joy, when that curiosity about fear becomes, oh, yes, I embrace it. And I did a funny thing. I said yes to what that fellow player said. I went where I didn't know where we'd end up. And that was the joy of it. And of course, that's incredibly transferable.
Do you know, Neil,
when I do a day at the work at the Comedy Store, we kind of come away and then I say, come and watch the show. And the people say, oh, now I get it. You really were working with each other. You really weren't sure where to go, but you knew you were going there together. That's the joy of it.
It's a huge element of trust, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been taught by Mike Myers, and I've done it with Paul Merton and Josie Lawrence and Greg Brooks, great practitioners. And none of us would pretend to be great leaders in proper jobs. What is interesting is how this is such an applicable technology. And as Adam just said, anybody can do it. It's like any skill. It's just, are you able to talk? Actually, are you able to listen? Actually, are you able to take on board what somebody else said, whatever you can and can't do, whatever language you do or don't speak? It's very simple. But of course, it's quite difficult if you've learned over 20, 30 years to be fearful about uncertainty and ambiguity.
Here's a question for the two of you then, chaps. Do you remember the first time that you were asked or you realized of the transferable nature of this skill set? When was the first time that you took it out of theatre or out of improv comedy and went elsewhere?
Well, I know Neil has the answer because I interviewed him about this very thing for my book. So I will let him go for it.
Great. Oh, Adam's think alike.
Adam's story is fantastic. It was a moment. It was a true moment. Beres & Edmunds Theatre Royal. I think I'd just done my GMAT, which is a thing. I don't know if you guys know this.
What's
where
that?
You have to take an exam to, you know, if you want to do an MBA. And I did pretty well.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, I could do an MBA. And various people said, do you want to do an MBA? My wife said, do you want to do an MBA? You love doing comedy. I said, all right, maybe I could do the both without doing an MBA. Or people said, yes, of course you can. So I happened to be at Bury St. Edmunds Theatre Royal, Bury St. Edmunds, small town in Suffolk with a most beautiful theatre. And I'd been asked to do a workshop in comedy, and last week they had Jimmy Cricket, and the week after they had Prunella Scales from Fawlty Towers.
Yes.
And I was doing improv, and so I got there early and I said to everyone, oh, can I just come into my room one by one? I said, here's the secret of improv, and just a bit of paper saying listen. And just seeing these people who were not performers professionally, some were A-level drama students, but they were agricultural workers, lawyers, just saying yes. And there was this moment where this guy, I could see he let go of the fear and he said something and he just opened up. His whole body went, yeah, I did it. And he said something that was a bit cheeky, and he wouldn't have said it in real life.
Right.
But we all applauded him because we all knew that's what he wanted to say, and we would have said it for him. And the curiosity overwhelmed him to become joy. The fear became creativity. And that was the moment I thought, wow, there's something here. And I don't necessarily need to do an MBA. I need to get my shtick together to understand how to say, well, I'm doing improv and it's applicable in X, Y, Z way. But I, at that point, thought this is something more than just teaching people who want to do it on stage.
I love the fact that you can be that specific in relation to time, date, place of where that transformation took place. But Adam, you're smiling at me, so you must remember too, right?
No, I do indeed. It was very early on in my career working in executive education. So mm-hmm. I was just a few years out of doing my MBA. And, you know, until that point, a lot of what we were doing was would felt and sounded and, you know, very academic. Very much, we're going to teach you stuff and you're going to be hopefully inspired, but you're going to learn things. And I was approached by Tesco. With and a team there that was led by one of my classmates from London Business School, who said, we want to work on how do we have fun together on a daily basis, right? Just as being part of a team.
What a loaded question.
How do we just get more comfortable being, you know, spontaneous?
Yep.
And so of course, I went right to, you know, my old world of improv. And I said, well, it's got to be, we've got to spend a day doing improv. So we rented the Royal Court Theater at, you know, in Sloane Square, beautiful theater. Of course, like most fun fact for all you out there, West End theaters, you can rent very cheaply. Well, particularly now, but even post COVID, very cheaply when the, you know, show isn't happening, right? Because as far as the theater owner is concerned, then that's just
free
dead money.
Yeah.
Just sitting there. So as long as there's nothing hazardous on the stage, you can probably ask them, you know, promise not to break anything. You could probably do stuff on a West End stage any day of the week if they're not performing or rehearsing. Anyway, so we rented the theater and we had the and we didn't tell them. We did, because I didn't want them obsessing and tossing and turning all night, going, oh God, this is going to be terrible. And of course, making excuses and suddenly coming down with a cold.
Surprise.
So we didn't tell them what we were going to do with them. We said, just show up at Sloane Square Station at 8:30 in the morning on such and such a day. I believe it was 2007. I can't get more specific than that. and wear comfortable clothes.
I love that.
And we brought them in and we had them sit in the audience in the empty Royal Court Theater. And only then did I explain what we were going to do and the looks on their faces, as you can imagine. I wouldn't have had more shock and awe than if I were streaking across the stage. But
that's another story. End,
you don't want to, you never, no one wants to see that. And by the end, they were overjoyed. And several of them came up to me instead at the beginning, and we did all day. We did improv with people who had never done improv before for almost 8 hours.
Right.
And by the end, they said, you know, I was terrified at the beginning. And now they're like, I would do this again in a heartbeat. And it wasn't just that, you know, that all of a sudden they became more confident performing with for one another, but just that they were more comfortable with each other, that when they would get together facing different challenges, they would go, okay, what's going on here, right? What's our context? What's the relationship of us with this customer? How can we change that relationship in this next 30-minute meeting? Things like that. In other words, it got quite granular in terms of how they were going to use this going forward. And going back to the first point I made, you know, very early on, over half this group spoke English as at least a second language.
That's incredible.
Didn't matter at all.
I mean, what you're both describing is transformational change in people. And so I did a little bit of digging, chaps. Let me just share. There was an experiment, and I can't remember where I got this from, but let's just go with it. And they saw that improv comedians, 20% more ideas than professional designers, and the ideas were 25% more creative. And then there was another stat that said when business teams warmed up like comedians, it boosted the idea output by 37%. Now, whether those stats are correct or not, why is that happening? What's going on?
Less judgment.
Tell me more.
Less judgment. Ideas can be created and co-created, and it doesn't matter if this one doesn't work. But actually, the joy is in improv, I don't know if it's going to work, but I trust the process, and you and I and we will make it work.
Right.
And we don't mind if at this moment we're not sure where it's going to go. We don't mind if when we look back on the scene, there was a bit where it was a bit, what's going to happen next? What seemed to be the idea didn't seem to be quite working, but we knew that that dip, that little ebb would leave us ready to go over the waterfall when it finally flowed. And that's the difference. And that's what it was, that fearful moment, Sloane Square, 8:30. And they sat in the auditorium thinking, we can only get this wrong. By the end of the day, getting it wrong is impossible. You just, the more wrong you get it, the more right it is, in a way. You just commit the idea. A friend of mine called John Creamer, for him, improv is listen, accept, commit. Listen to what's being said. Accept that's the offer now. You're a doctor, you're a chicken. Commit. Be a great chicken. Be an angry doctor. Be a happy doctor. Find a way for the doctor and the chicken to have something in common or something.
I love it. It's a doctor or a chicken. It's great.
I mean, it's a great point. You know, when you think about how brainstorming typically happens in a boardroom, everyone is simultaneously proposing ideas and judging the ideas instead of just coming up with ideas. And even better, plussing those ideas, right? In improv, the technology is yes anding one another's ideas, right? No matter what idea you come up with, I'll say, yes, I accept that idea, and let me build on it. So it's complete suspension of judgment. And it's funny, I love yes. We all love that little bit of self-affirmation to hear people say yes to an idea, but yes, and?
Wow, I want to come on to this.
Saying that idea is so brilliant, let's just play in that space for a while. And sometimes people have told me when we've used the yes and piece in a business brainstorming context, people said, you know what, ultimately the idea we're going to go with, that we're committing to, we never would have gone with unless we did yes and. Yes would not be sufficient. It's a necessary requirement, but it's not sufficient. What yes and allowed us to do is to explore what that possibility looks like. So all of a sudden, you know, the light bulb clicked on and we go, okay, this is something quite interesting. But in too many boardrooms, you know, there's always someone who's like, this is why that idea is not going to work. The famous black hat rule. And so just out of basic ideation workshop, you know, where I would use improv would be just that, talking about yes and yes and, to help people think about, if you're asking people for ideas, you have to get out of immediately considering the feasibility of every idea. Because right. Once you shoot down an idea from someone, particularly someone junior or someone who's, you know, who's not confident or someone who's new to the team, you will never hear a new idea from them again. Their role thereafter for the rest of their time in your organization will be to listen for someone else's idea, to look around and see if that idea is getting an affirmation, and then they'll yes and the idea. But you will never get an idea, a genuine new idea from that person. And just that is a very simple technical reason why you know one improv tool can help transform a team's creativity.
I love the yes and tool, and so Neil, let me come over to you. Help listeners understand what yes and is in a way that they could take it themselves and experiment with it in their team. Be their team, be 2 people, 20 people, 200 people, who knows?
Well, it's a good question, because a lot of people think yes and is all about just saying yes to any old nonsense. And one guy said to me, from a big oil company, we do too much yes and, we need a bit of yes but. For him, it wasn't rigorous like it is on the stage. We're creating a story. And so the yes and is heading towards something. We don't know where it is, but we know it's going to be a story, and there's a relationship and there's characters. It's not just mindless, yes, we'll do that, yes, we'll do that. It's actually, no, we'll take that one thing and move that forward, then add another thing to it. We don't know where the idea came from, but we will co-create. So yes and is an ethos. It's an actual game we play. So we get people to say yes and.
Right.
If you go and see an improv show, you won't actually see much of the words yes and. You'll see everything about the ethos. I'm taking on board your offer. Yes, of course, I'm a chicken. Have you seen my hen or something? I didn't know I was entering the scene to be a chicken, but you gave it to me. And as Adam Kay said just now, when I yes and your idea, you feel great. And you feel you want to yes and my idea. So yes and, in fact, in improvis, we use it as a verb. I'm yes anding you.
Right.
So you can play the game. I'm going to the shops. Yes, and I'll buy some cheese. Yes, and we'll make a cheese sandwich. Yes, and we'll have a picnic with the sandwiches. Yes, and I'll bring a rug. Okay, fine. That's fairly easy. The thing is, of course, it's not always as obvious that, because what kind of cheese, what kind of picnic, where are we going to have the picnic, what kind of rug? There's always something there. And I talk about exploring assumptions, and it's fun to say to somebody, yeah, bring the rug you got from Daphne. Of course, then the story emerges. Bad improvisers go, hello, who are you? Hello, I'm somebody. Really? What's going on? Something. Look, it's over there. We're not committing to the scene.
Right.
So that's what plussing is, the word they use at Pixar Pictures, which is I'm plussing the idea. I'm taking the idea and adding something to it. And whether I did like it or not is not, you know, it's irrelevant where it came from. We're co-creating it. So yes, and as a mindset. Of course, when we get interested, we begin to see that yes, but if used judiciously, means we can advance even further. But we know that yes, but is so easy, as Adam Kay just said. Yes, but it won't work. Yes, but we've tried it before. Yes, but it's too expensive. These are great yes, but technicians who can tell you why nothing will work.
Right.
Of course, the words, yes, but we could have a picnic in Daphne's house or something. You can see, especially in English, the word at some point, it's the energy of building on the idea. So I call it listen and link. Listen to what you're saying and link something to it for the next part of the story. So people will get a bit upset about, I don't want to yes and my customer when they're, or my, you know, I'm a consultant, they're saying a wrong thing and I'm yes anding them incorrectly. Fine. Use what they said to then build the conversation. Taking what on board, what somebody said as an offer. Oh yes, I'll use a word you said and I'll build it up. It's useful in networking. You know, you're at a party, you meet somebody and you say, oh, I've just come back from a skiing holiday. And they say, I hate skiing. Okay, that's a perfect example of the block.
Yeah.
So yes and is, you can use it in the elevator. You can use it as a young person just chatting to a client, just building on, oh, right, that she said that. Or if I just throw something back connected with what she said, I've got a conversation going. I don't have to think of stuff. And she feels I'm listening to her. It's great. And I'm working with what matters to her. So yes anding is really treating what the other person says as an offer.
Right.
That's where it comes from. And I'm trying to learn offer in as many languages as possible. Erbjudande in Swedish. An offer is something somebody gives you, you can do something with, which was created by a guy called Rob Poynton, who wrote a book about improv. An offer is something somebody gives you, you can do something with. Isn't that great? And it could be a customer, a client, a team member, that junior person Adam mentioned, who's just said something. It may not be a great idea, but if you use what she has given you, what he has contributed, oh, they'll want to play more. And actually, it could be the genesis of a great idea. It could be the start of something. It may not be the final idea, but if we co-create it, then we're going to go to a place perhaps that neither of us expected, but for which we both have some responsibility.
It has so much application to so many people for so many reasons. And one thing I want to come back to is, I think you said, whilst we might watch improv teams aghast at just how skillful they are, from your experience, gents, you can get regular people like me doing improv pretty quick, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Immediately.
When you're doing it now, Adam Pacifico, by the way, you're listening to us and you're finding something to build on, to give to us. You're throwing us the ball.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing. You don't call it improv. You just call it being human. Anyone can do it.
I was working with a top team in Australia, working in, for a mining company, and everyone was saying, you know, oh, you're in trouble now. You got a whole week with the big hairy miners. And not just that, the leaders of the big hairy miners, the biggest and the hairiest of the miners. And whole week. And one hour of one of those days, we did some improv, including yes and.
Right.
And afterward, we tried to get a little bit of feedback. We just called some of their direct reports and said, you know, what have you observed? What's going on? Have the conversations changed at all? And they almost to a person said, what did you do to them? and of all the things we talked about, most of which was on a more of an intellectual level, the thing that they were observing, that they were experiencing, even if they couldn't quite put their thumb on what it was their, that this top team were yes anding.
So it's a behavior thing.
Changed the tenor of the company, right? Because that as soon as everyone, all the role models in the organization start behaving a different way, that de facto changes the culture. Because everyone's looking around at the influential people and saying, well, if I behave the way they're behaving, then surely I will be successful around here too.
One smile at a time.
Yes, exactly. When you're smiling,
see what I did there?
Yes, and can lead you. You're thinking, oh, why don't I create more smiles? And so we know that when we have a breakthrough creatively, we smile. And I think it's really important. Dale Carnegie used to say, you know, smile will break. It's the shortest distance between two people or something like that. There's lots of things we can do by allowing humor. And it's interesting that the Tesco team you work with, Adam Kay, wanted to, how do we have fun together? Not just have fun, but because that creates the right culture. Mm. And the yep. yes and in a broader context, as soon as I see the senior people behaving in a way that's embracing ideas from other places, that's a great offer. Oh, right. Means I can go talk to them. Means I can perhaps be more open to suggestions from my gang. So the offer is not just a word. It's a way of being, you know, in that's what's joyous about improv. It's both an interpersonal skill, but as a leader, it's a broader mindset. You know, what's the offer from the market now? What's the offer from technology? What's the offer from consumer behavior? Oh, no, things have changed. Oh, no, damn, our plan is wrong. Oh, hang on. Of course, the improviser is thinking, there's a moment here where if I really can find what the offer is, what's going on in people's lives, behavior, spending decisions, I can use that to build and what can I yes and here rather than say, oh, it hasn't worked out how I planned. No, be nimble, be adaptable, find what's going on in reality and use that.
So here's a question for the two of you. There, I hope, will be many leaders listening to this. And when we say leader, I'm really talking about anyone and everyone because leadership starts with self. So whether it's an 18-year-old sat in a garage hoping to create the next disruptive company and they are just leading themselves, or small, medium, large businesses. You know, I spoke to someone today who works at an organization that is based in 50 countries with 230,000 people and everything in between. So I want this to be applicable to anyone listening thinking, I can see the power and I want to be courageous enough to start to have a go at this. And there was a wonderful phrase I saw about being intentionally playful. How can leaders be intentionally playful? So if someone is listening to this and they could be at the top of a large organization, in the middle, at the start of their career, how could they start the process of bringing some improv and spontaneity into their business and leadership? Where do they start?
Oh, well, so many different directions. I mean, certainly we've talked a lot about yes and. That's a simple personal habit. Yep. that I truly believe can transform the dynamic of a team. But another one that I think has been particularly useful for pretty much anyone in business, if they're like an entrepreneur, as yep. you said, in a garage, or excuse me, in their garage, or if they're leading a large number of people, they are obsessed with sales, right? Customer relations. And too often what I find is people become more senior, they become more distant from their customers, right? There are more and more buffers, layers between them and the customer. So what improv can help them do is to become more curious about their customers again, right? Which is kind of the first thing you do in when you're setting up an improv yeah. scene. You know, one of the places where I trained is the Groundlings in LA. They, you know, like Second City, you know, they send a lot of people to Saturday Night Live ultimately. And you know, one habit that they drilled into us is that the very first thing you should do in a scene is establish the scene, right? In other words, who am I? Who are you? Where are we? What are we doing? What's our relationship, right? Just set that. Don't do anything until you've set that up, because then you can relax and the audience can relax, because now you kind of know mm-hmm. the context. You set up the context. Well, let's apply this to what I'm talking about in business. Leaders are making assumptions about the context, the relationship of their organization to their customers that may have been valid 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 25 years ago, when they actually talked to customers.
Right.
So starting to get into that ethos and asking even those same types of questions that you'll be doing in an improv would be really helpful, even to the extent of actually literally getting those leaders out back into the field, talking to customers and asking those similar questions. What's your relationship to my organization? What products or services do you use? How do you use them? What do you think about that? Et cetera, right? That curiosity.
Yeah, I was going to say,
you know,
curiosity.
What Neil has talked about a lot, which is so important. Because I think the more senior we become, the more, unfortunately, too many people get lazy about their assumptions, particularly about the attractiveness of their products and services.
Right. So Neil, same question to you, please. So,
well, exactly. I have a 5-letter mnemonic, and number four is E for explore assumptions. Back to my improv scene, what kind of chicken are you? Why are you seeing the doctor today? Why have a picnic? There's always questions. As Mike Myers used to say, why have the gods of improv chosen now to land upon this scene? So there's never any moment where you can't get more specific. What kind of Tuesday is it? What are we eating? Why do I want to share my picnic with you? And so I'd say, first of all, yeah, get out and talk to your customers and really talk openly in a really, what I call intentive listening. What's really listening to what she's saying? Talk to the people on the front line, those people who are selling stuff, who are having to go to door to door or on the shop floor, whatever. People are near the process that matters to the customer and to your people. Talk to your suppliers. How many times do we forget to talk to our suppliers? And I think a job of a leader, whether they're leading one person or, you know, 1 million, as you said, or 230,000, talk to people who are doing the thing. And what's interesting is when I've heard, I think it's the young guy who used to run GlaxoSmithKline, and he said, the danger of being a CEO is when you mention something, it becomes an order, right. Becomes a command.
From above.
So how do we, so people will put on you as a leader, they'll try and restrict your improvisational curiosity because they think you know the answer. And the best leaders I've got are endlessly curious.
Yeah.
In improv, just like the who, what, and where, the groundlings drummed into you, Adam, it was always, how does my character change in the scene? What is she learning? And that's a great thing. If every conversation you've learned something, and it may well be that you've learned something about yourself, you've learned something about the product, you've learned something about the business in terms of production, whatever, but it's ultimately curious. Every improv scene has a million possibilities. And so at its root, improv is about listening and treating what you hear as an offer upon which to build.
Yeah, it's that intense curiosity,
isn't
it?
That really is it. So get out there and talk to people, whether you're in your garage, go and talk to a customer, go and talk to the next door neighbor, go and talk to the people doing the same thing as you. Find out what they're doing, if you can.
Yeah, so Neil, just in case anyone missed the mnemonic, you mentioned a mnemonic.
I did. I used to call it lager, then I give people a beer mat. I'm just showing that to the Zoom screen. Listen for offers.
Yep.
Accept offers. So that means accept that's the way things are, or the way that's the way she sees the world or he's thinking. Give offers. And I call it now S for send an offer back. And then E for explore assumptions. Your assumptions. How do you feel? What are you filtering out? How are you biased? What it means you don't notice stuff. And also, if you are a consultant working in a shop, whatever, the assumptions the customer has about you, do they think you're only doing this or something that? And the last one, this is an improv word, reincorporate. And so if I can, that spells lager, my beer mat, but I'm doing laser now for send an offer. So the last one is reincorporate, which possibly Adam Kay will know this, is it's great in a scene where something comes back. And so that's where your spontaneous storytelling. Great stories aren't just something happened, something happened, something happened, something happened, the end. Great stories are one thing leads to another. Something happened early in the story, and then the character remembers it. He finds that object, remembers that piece of advice, goes back to the mentor. And this is where Pixar is so good at storytelling, by the way.
Yeah, their own, the Pixar story improv-based
structure for stories. Yeah, Pixar have lots of story things, but they have there's a thing called the story spine, which is, I think, is from a guy called Ken Adams, who is from the world of improv. But you can see when you're creating spontaneous story, you want structure, but you want adaptive structure. So for me, the art of lager or laser is remembering what people said a bit ago. That person didn't say much in the meeting. Bring back that offer, because it could be great to bring it in now. So it's a co-creative process. It's also, don't we feel nice when I'm at that party? I just say, I come back from a ski holiday and somebody says 10 minutes later, oh, we're a bit off-piste here, or something like that. Just plays back a little bit of what I said and it becomes a smile. It doesn't become a massive joke. It becomes a little bit of a smile, in the same way that when Eddie Izzard brings back Mrs. Bad Crumble, when Michael McIntyre brings back a character from before or a notion, an idea. It's called a callback in sitcoms. When something seemed coincidental, we bring it back. It has both storytelling and rapport possibilities.
It's becoming so common in stand-up. You see that you know that a comedian is reaching the end of their set when they're using the callback,
right?
Which I think, as Neil said, I think a lot of that has been shamelessly stolen from Eddie Izzard, among a couple of others. But you just know as soon as all the characters and jokes and references start coming back hard and fast, they're wrapping it up. And for global relevance, of course, we acknowledge that Neil's acronym LAGER in the Middle East is simply REGAL.
Thank you. Yes,
I see what you did there.
Not everyone knows what lager is, by the way. So that's why I'm going for laser. It sounds good. And at its deepest, laser is because light can be both particle and wave. In the same way that improv embraces the individual and the team player. My quantum mechanics is that improv at its best, you're great on your own because you help the other people.
I love
it. And one of the things about improv, the sort of quiet ethos elements, is if I can make you look good, then I've done a good job. And actually, I look pretty good. And that's very good. The more I can bring you into the story, the more I can use your offers, the greater you look. And actually, that triumph, that joy, that gold dust is sprinkled over the whole cast. How do I make my partner look good? Is one of the stories of improv. And that's a bit surprising to people.
Yeah, wow. So important for company culture, right? Because too often, I think we've probably experienced companies where the ethos is, how can I make my colleagues look bad so that somehow by extension, I look good? And that is, of course, a self-defeating strategy.
Well, I love the fact that I've got a screenshot now of a beer mat with Neil's Rules of Improv on my screen. Make friends and interest people. I could talk to you chaps for ages because I love this particular subject and I love its application to leaders and leadership. It's so important. So let me ask you both this question. Adam, how can people get in touch with you? I know you've got your second book coming out, your first book, which was a fabulous, Next Generation Leadership. How can people get hold of you?
Yeah, two ways. I have a website, which has all my details as well as more information. Right. Super easy to remember. It's www.adamkingle.com. As if you go back to the link, hopefully on the webpage for this podcast, you'll see there is no E in my surname. So it's KINGL, adamkingle.com.
Gotcha. There we go.
Other way is that I'm on the faculty of a lovely organization called PCA, which Adam P can tell you more about another day. So I can certainly be found there as well.
Oh, thank you for that plug. I appreciate that too, Adam. Neil, how can people get hold of you?
Well, neilmalarkey.com, there is an E there. Or I don't know if people remember that. Hopefully it'll be in some sort of thing you send them, neilmalarkey.com.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's easier to go improvyourbiz.com. So improv your, as in the whole pronoun, your biz, B-I-Z, improvyourbiz.com. But I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram. I'd love to hear from people because I have learned so much. I started doing this in 1999, and I didn't do my MBA, but I've learned so much. I thought improv was quite helpful to a few people in some areas. And what I've learned is that it's hugely applicable in nearly every area. Leadership, creativity, sales, confidence, all the things that Adam Kingle without an E has mentioned. So that's been my learning. I've learned so much. So it'd be great to get in touch with people, to hear from people, because I bet you all have a story where improv was happening and made things better, even though you didn't call it improv.
Gotcha. Perhaps. Yeah. Now, I want to end with a question, which, Adam, I may have asked you this in the episode that you and I did last year, so you get to answer this again. I want to know, what would be your best advice to a 21-year-old self? And so, Adam, I'm going to go straight to you, because you may have thought about this previously in our last episode. Best advice to a 21-year-old self, and then I'll come to you, Neil.
Yeah, well, you know, certainly one thing which I think I maybe people told me, but I didn't actually believe back then, is that the world is changing so fast that whatever you think you're going to be doing with your life is almost without a doubt not what you're going to ultimately be doing with your life.
That's so true.
It reminds me of the Yiddish joke: "Want to make God laugh? Show him your plans."
Yeah.
So certainly, though as cliched as it might sound, follow your passion and follow your joy, because. I think trying to pursue professional relevance, I would tell my 21-year-old self is a very quick ride into sadness.
Good advice. Neil, best advice.
Is it to my own 21-year-old self?
Yes.
Or a generic 21-year-old?
No, it's to you.
Well, I'm just trying to work out what I was doing when I was 21. I was just in my final year of university.
That's okay.
And to be honest with you, I'd say to him, read those books that you bought, because it doesn't go in by osmosis.
And as they say, the rest is history. I think for this episode, we need... Yeah, I've got to play with it, haven't I? Listen, I just want to say, chaps, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me. I've had loads of fun. This is going to be a fab episode. We will share it with the world and beyond. And I hope that you'll come back to me if you start to get contacted by people and the conversation continues, and come back and share what you're learning. Would you do that for
me? Thank you. And thank you for letting me be an honorary Adam.
I hope you'll both come back to me for another episode when who knows what we'll talk about.
That was great fun. Thank you both.
Thank you.
For today. Appreciate it.
Join us again next week for more essential insights on the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with your host on LinkedIn or via our website, www.pca-global.com. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. Thanks for listening.